about now is we have the food supply is already large enough.
Right. So my name is Jean-Philippe. Tonight is going to be a very, I hope, a very intense night, because we're going to take on a science, economics, ecology, and hopefully we're going to have a good exchange afterwards. But the just to put people maybe more into the what type of situation we're in. Because this is basically the office of the LaRouche movement in Canada. And we have, we're present also in other regions in the United States. And next week, we were supposed to go down for a week of action in Washington, D.C., in the U.S. Capitol, because LaRouche, Lyndon LaRouche from the Democratic Party, is going to give a speech, which he gives regularly, maybe it's a once a month, something like that, in D.C., you know, for decision makers, for the population in general, worldwide, where it usually goes into a lot about, you know, economic policies, you know, how to stop the danger of war, how to put George Bush in a place where he's going to be happy and thinking about other people. And it's a very, it's a very long process. You know, like a lot of people, they go to school and they study for like 4 years, 10 years. But sometimes when you try to change politics, it can take more than that. Okay. So there's a lot of butt heads, no? Heads knocking each other in D.C. or any other places in terms of what will be the future policies of our nation. And so tonight we're going to talk a lot about Mr. Al Gore. In his infamous documentary. Not that we're going to dissect the whole thing, but because if you haven't heard about Gore, I think you've heard about the study of ecology, environmentalism, which got a lot of people attracted to politics, right? People, they hear about, you know, all these this report about mankind's impact on the world. But also the policies that are promoted in terms of solving this so-called problem, the supposed problem. There are more and more worldwide, there are more and more people discussing about how the hell we're going to implement those policies. And but there's other people like us who, you know, because LaRouche is, for example, he was at the Italian Parliament recently, where he discussed for about 20 minutes, half an hour inside the Italian Parliament during the session, to go back into you know, the situation we're in terms of the economic collapse that we're facing, but also and mainly the solution to that, you know? Because that's a bit, I think that's a bit the debate we're going to have, you know, what will be the future policies of our nations? Are we going to go towards a reduction of man's activity, like what's been promoted a lot recently and massively? Also, people remember a bit in newspapers the last few weeks. You know, most of the free newspapers, they had their cover about, you know, climate change, or people going on a bike ride in Ottawa to go complain and to talk with youth about man's impact in the biosphere and stuff like that. And but I think the problem that we encountered in on our organizing, because we go out every day, or almost every day, or whether we do work on the phone, talk with people that we met or talk to new people about not just LaRouche's policies, but to try to get a sense of how things are working. You know, how does history function? How does economics work? You know, and how we're going to stop, you know, this huge mess, whether in the Middle East or in terms of our economy within Canada or African nations, this collapse, you know, of the capabilities of production and capabilities of sustaining people. And the funny thing with climate change, suddenly it's really funny when you think about it. But it's sometimes you meet a lot of what we call in the scientific term is a headless chicken, where a lot of people they're awfully scared. We had discussions with people about, you know, better stop Dick Cheney, he's a fascist, blah, blah, blah. And people would stop you and say, no, the real problem is climate change. We got 20 years, you know, we got 20 years to go. We got 30 years to go. And it was very hard to bring them back to the debate, to the discussion that you wanted to have with them, which were discussions that we had before, no problem. You know, you would stop people. Wouldn't even talk about that. You know, in the last few months, it was really the question of war. There was the main issue in people's mind, and of course, the question of economy. But now, it's like you mentioned the word change, and people say climate change. Right? So I got to change my baby's diaper. Climate change. You know? So people have developed a reflex of which is understandable if you know, when you have problems, people remember 9/11. I mean, people were not in the best mood to start discussing about big issues, or you know, what's the nature of man, or how does history function, you know, what is imperialism. The people were afraid, and there was a consistent bashing in the media about whether Bin Laden. Like you had Tony Blair, I remember Tony Blair that came out with 70 proofs that Bin Laden is the culprit, you know, and he had this big, that was published in La Presse, you know, so basically 70 facts about Bin Laden, about how he's a bad person, which is true, but did he really do 9/11? You know, but that's another debate. I think the key thing we want to do, and we're going to go through that a lot more during the night, but it's to go through a bit the origins of those ideas of environmentalism, and also go through LaRouche's approach in terms of economics. You know, because it's not just that, you know, he's in some type of old guy that we kind of like, and he's, you know, he give us candies, and so we stick with him. That there's some very powerful ideas that the guy developed, and it's going to be very important in terms of shaping, you know, the foreign policies of our nations, and also the domestic policies, because you know that's the importance of a youth movement. The future is not going to be built by, you know, dying people. They might help, but the next policymakers, you know, it's people from this room, people we're going to meet very soon, you know, between 18 to 30 years of age, which will be the next people taking the decisions, you know, which is not an easy thing, right? If you or if people have any experience in terms of politics, if you go against the flow, sometimes you tend to get very discouraged, and you tend to maybe sometimes just put this, you know, changing the world thing beside to whether get more friends and try to get into the system and try to change things after you got into the system, or to really get this debate on ideas right now. Because, and that, I think that's an important point, because Al Gore, who's now all over the place, you know, he might get a Nobel Prize, he got an Academy Award, so, but he's in the Democratic Party, just as LaRouche. So, and LaRouche has been emphasizing certain policies that goes directly against what Gore is talking about, right? And our movement has been gradually building an enormous support for LaRouche's policies, and at the same time pushing those people, or elevating those people, I'd say, to implement those policies, to go against the flow, in a sense, to go out and fight. You know, you can have a good, nice idea, but if people don't agree with it, then you have to debate that idea. You have to prove, that it's the proper one, and you have to refute other ideas that are being presented. And that's what we're trying to do tonight. We're not gonna we're not going to bombard you with just thousands of statistics because, you know, that's not necessarily a proof of anything. You know, like, I could show you statistics about that the climate change or the global warming is not really occurring, but some other guys could come up with, you know, 700 pages of other statistics. So yeah, we have to really go into this question of economics and what is man's role in the biosphere, because we're there, you know, and we're not going to disappear. So what would be our, on what type of principles are we going to base our policies? You know? Because LaRouche on the March 7th is going to give this webcast, which is titled "The Implications of the Gore Hoax for International Policies." And that's what we're going to go through, basically. How this is a hoax, and what's the backbone? What's behind all this? And how does that apply today and this whole worldwide dynamics?
So you said something about the Kyber School?
Yeah. Good point. This weekend, so leaving tomorrow, we'll have a cadre school. Some people here came for a cadre school in Montreal. But we're going to go down for a weekend in Boston. Starting Friday, we're going to come back here on Saturday, which are these regular cadre school that we do in terms of working, you know, on certain ideas. It's basically like a university in which you get an education, unlike some others. And the idea is to have a group of youth working on economics, working in history, music, different parts of our curriculum, and then get this out in the street. Because after that cadre school, there's going to be a week of action here in Montreal, and we're going to have some people in Ottawa as well to go, whether University of Ottawa, Carleton, downtown Ottawa, because there's an area where you have a lot of embassies, diplomats, that we should hit with, you know, the documentation that we have, and also in Montreal here to keep the work going, get people involved, and get people a better sense of how things work. So yeah, so I mean, that's we can discuss about at the end. People want to come. It's never too late. So I have some places. We're gonna go drive by car over there. So yeah, Matt.
Hey. Well, yeah, I think I'd like to start this evening off with this idea of left and right, first of all, and you get this in the street a lot, talking to people, trying to figure out, well, like LaRouche, is this guy more left or is he more right? Or, you know, which way do you lean? And, you know, largely in our society, it's really become very, very fashionable to pick one or the other of the two. And, I mean, whether that's, like, you know, John Stewart or Rush Limbaugh or Democrat or Republican or liberal or conservative or Pepsi or Coke, it's one or the other. And in the midst, you know, you, like JP just said, you have Al Gore here, who's in the Democratic Party. LaRouche is in the Democratic Party in the States, and yet ontologically you can't categorize one as being left or right. So really, what's the real questions that we have to ask, or what do we really have to look at when we're looking at our world? And I'm going to start off by just asking, I guess, overall, it might be a little rhetorical in nature, but would anybody here disagree that saving a child is a good idea? If you have a life that you could save, it's pretty good. It's not a bad idea, right, to do that? Would you say that would be even a good idea? Yeah. And, I mean, I think that you would include that for a village, 10 villages. There's an idea of good there. Okay, good. Well,
now your consensus.
Was that? Yeah, sweet. Yeah, I didn't think I'd have to pull too hard for that one. But, overall, let me just kind of go off on a slight little tangent. I mean, I look at my body and I look at two hands that I have, and once again, they're left and right. And I got to try not to forget the fact that these hands are connected to the same body, which is driven by the same mind. And occasionally, you know, you having your two hands in your body might find yourself inside of a Walmart or a Zellers, and you'll be carried by an idea to buy a product, you know, it might be a PlayStation or Xbox. I mean, who knows, or a movie ticket. But And this is the big thing that we all take for granted, but how much of that desire to buy that product is of our own will, and how much of it was shaped by how many conversations you may have had, how many advertisements you may have seen. I mean, it's a really dynamic process that went into putting you in that position where you're wondering whether you're going to buy Adidas or Nike. And I mean, your own opinion too will definitely have an effect after you buy it. While you're playing this game, you'll be going out and shaping the will of others. Or this is a dynamic process of ideas. And I mean, me myself, I worked in advertising for a little while, and let me tell you right up front, this is the desire that you have does not originate with you in any way. This is something that originated in the mind of somebody in an office, a little copywriter who's getting paid to do just that and think about how exactly, what principles could work on selling a product to anybody. And so I think when our opinions in life are slowly developed, it's very important to take a step outside of oneself and of one circle of close friends, of the media, school, and even society as a whole. And be able to sort of look at that from that perspective. And I mean, because it's not really just consumerism or greed that this effect operates on, but real international policies, history, is a process of these ideas being shaped, or shaping events and actions. And, I mean, our very identities in that society are shaped by those ideas as well. And this is, we live our lives and we don't tend to take a step out of ourselves and see it for that which it is. But I mean, how can we ever think in terms of, you know, right or wrong or what principles to work for if we're always stuck in a process of left and right? And all of history has to be understood as that interchange of ideas. So, I mean, when it comes down to knowing the events, the intentions of the revolutions, you have movements throughout history, it's good to know these dates and events, and that's handy to know, but only if you're willing to learn from them and to understand what principles were guiding those beyond your senses. Because by themselves, your senses, these dates are stupid. They won't tell you the root cause. And I mean, that might put you in a position where, like, today, everybody out there, most people in Canada that I speak to, anyhow, are all assuming that what's going on in the Middle East right now is for greed or oil or opium fields, or the military-industrial complex. But is there something deeper there? And with that, I mean, it's good to look at the world right now as being 6 billion people on it. You got over 1.5 million who die every day. You've got AIDS right now running rampant throughout the world, killing, you know, untold millions in Africa, China. You got 350 million people living in poverty. Although you have this society that people think of as being successful, they don't see that the only reason China is successful as a whole is because it's begun to loot, and well, it's a big portion of its own people have to live like animals, and that's an economic requirement. Russia, 20 years ago, you had Russia as a powerhouse of the world, and today you've got a negative population growth. You've got 500 million people, or 500... 1,000, thank you, Ilko. Less this year than last year who are being born. Mexico, 650 million people are emigrating out of there because they cannot buy food. They've got most of their corn prices are rising because you have a move towards ethanol. Ethanol, which is a new product to replace gas that's being sold as the next great thing to be an alternative energy source, which is causing their prices of corn, wheat to rise, well, it's double in the last few months. So, you know, you have this effect going on, and you've got wars raging in the Middle East. You've got Condi Rice, who's breaking up a new government that was being proposed in Palestine, and that would have actually been a step towards some form of a peaceful process in a region that's just a fire. And there's this continuing throwing of kindling wood onto this fire. And if you just relied on your senses, I mean, one would really have to be forced to assume that it's the United States that's at the core of this, that's causing this. Just look at them; they're huge. They've got imperial policies. They're raging through the world. I see it. It's about greed. It's corrupt. I see it. But that's But that's not really the whole thing. And I'm going to start, I guess, inspecting where another way we can look at the news or the events in our lives from the standpoint of one guy named Bertrand Russell. And just open the door. I mean, Bertrand Russell, he was a hugely influential factor in throughout Britain. He basically created this whole idea of preemptive nuclear strikes. Right after World War I, he wrote in depth representing Churchill how we have to, or America had to, use its atomic weapons upon Russia, the Soviet Union, before the Soviet Union actually had a chance to develop them. This is in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It's right there. And it didn't occur that way, but you have this guy who's being taught in school, whose students, philosophy majors, have to study him, learn him, understand where he's coming from. Not where he's coming from, but just what his standpoint is. And don't really ask what's driving this guy's thoughts or ideas. But I figured a couple of quotes from some of his texts in his earlier years that people tend to overlook would be handy to break it, open the door to what we're going to look at today. And the first thing that I wanted to look at was something called The Prospects for Industrial Civilization, which he wrote in 1923 as he was promoting communism in China. You had a humanist republic or a humanist movement in China occurring at the time under a president named Sun Yat-sen, which proved to be a danger to certain cartels, empire-oriented forces in politics that had other things planned for a world that could be used for its resources very well. So,
this is Bertrand Russell in his first little excerpt here.
Does anybody want to read by chance, Luke? Yeah.
Right. I don't know how to do that. Bigger?
You? It's on the top. You get percentages.
No, this thing?
Yes.
No, I didn't do it.
Okay.
All right.
When they put us up to the...
Well,
so it's the left box with your preview on the left side.
This?
Yeah, you'll see a little box there. Yeah,
that?
There's that one. It should...
Okay, well, it's not that. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, it could be worse. Yeah. So, does anybody feel like reading? Yeah, go for it.
Socialism, especially international socialism, is only possible in a stable system if the population is stationary or nearly so. A slow decrease might be coped with. Man, I don't know, I can't see clear enough from here, really. Sorry.
Oh, yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, I'll take care of it. Thanks for trying.
Yeah, if you want.
Socialism, especially international socialism, is only possible as a stable system if the population is stationary or nearly so. A slow increase might be coped with by improvements in agricultural methods, but a rapid increase must, in the end, reduce the whole population to penury. The white population of the world will soon cease to increase. The Asiatic races will be longer, and the Negroes still longer. The Asiatic races will be longer and the Negroes still longer before their birth rate falls sufficiently to make their numbers stable without help of war and pestilence. Until that happens, the benefits aimed at by socialism can only be partially realized, and the less prolific races will have to defend themselves against the more prolific by methods which are disgusting, even if they are necessary.
Yeah, lovely fellow. I figure one more quote by Russell should set the pace here. This one's actually from a later book that he wrote in 1953 called Science, The Impact of Science on Society. The whole book is pretty bad, but this one's a bit of a gem that I find is one of these little cues that we could look into, a paradox. Because I mean, this guy, when you when we think about him today, he's celebrated as a pacifist. He's got a peace prize named after him. So I think one of these little paradoxes in terms of learning from the past can be found in this one right here. You want that one again?
Is this Bertrand Russell again?
Yeah, Bertrand Russell again, yeah.
But bad times, you may say, are exceptional.
Yes.
And can be dealt with by exceptional methods. This has been more or less true during the honeymoon period of industrialism. But it will not remain true unless the increase of population can be enormously diminished. At present, the population of the world is increasing at about 58,000 per diem. War, so far, has had no very great effect on this increase, which continued through each of the world wars. War has hitherto been disappointing in this respect, but perhaps bacteriological war may prove more effective. If a black death could spread throughout the world once in every generation, survivors could procreate freely without making the world too full. The state of affairs might be somewhat unpleasant, but what of it? Really high-minded people are indifferent to happiness, especially other people's.
So that's not only is he a pacifist today, and not only is he taught in schools, not only does he have the Nobel Peace Prize, a Peace Prize still named after him. He's also really cherished and admired by such apparently left pacifists as Noam Chomsky. Bizarre. I mean, but when you think about it, then again, both of them are pro-depopulation, they're pro-world government, so is that really a big question at a certain point? So, as evil as this guy might sound, I mean, don't kid yourself, though. This isn't like a comic book, and it's not something out of a bad Batman comedy. This is... These guys don't... I mean, Bertrand Russell, he did have a pipe, and he looked pretty evil. But this isn't the type of evil that you can identify as being fed by egos or just the desire for, just evil for evil's sake. Like, this is something much more deeper, which underlies our society, which is really based in sense perception. And this is what we're going to look at a little bit more. But, I mean, really, if you were going to categorize something as being of this negative, you know, this type of anti-human concept of evil, then, I mean, empiricism, sense perception, would definitely qualify. Because this is what we're going to investigate, is what could make somebody rationally say something or have this type of an outlook upon the world. And it's a good starting point, but I think, and Bertrand Russell is definitely a good stepping stone to begin an investigation of. But one really has to look back a few more years to 1790 to this Venetian monk by the name of Gian Maria Ortes to understand the beginnings, or not even the beginnings, because it goes back much further than that, but in terms of the current conception of overpopulation, this guy's where we have to look. And he wrote something called the Riflessioni sulla Popolazione delle Nazioni. I think it's something like national...
Reflections on national population?
Yeah, based on an economy.
Okay.
National economy, yeah. So this is the first like formalized idea that human growth will naturally over-exceed the Earth's capacity to carry humans. And it was really put out there by this guy for the first time. And I don't have any pictures on him, but... His ideas were at the basis of other radical empiricists who came after him, who all tended to represent the interests of one British East India Company, which was, if you think British Empire, pre-20th century, I mean, you have to think British East India Company. This is what operated in terms of exploiting all of these nations. You might want to take the jacket off, it's hot. Okay. And the agents that would come out of this, the minds that would represent this this interest, this empire, are really are really powerful. And the people like Adam Smith were hugely influenced by Gian Maria and all of his philosophies. He, if anybody has ever taken an economics class, will be told that Adam Smith is the founder of the American system of economics. I mean, he developed the idea of free trade, wealth as just being material gain, man being operating for the pursuit of pleasure, the avoidance of pain. I mean, that's really, you know, the basis of that theory. And you had David Ricardo, too, hugely influenced by him. You had Jeremy Bentham, who developed, he was the first real monetarist in the sense of developing this is something called the hedonistic calculus. He worked for the British East India Company as well, but he developed the idea that you could divide all humankind into 33 some odd pleasures and 33 some odd vices, and using the combination of all of those, you could define how valuable currency would be in the flow of a system. It goes deeper, but this is a basic idea of how their logic worked, in that you could take something like humanity and break it down into equations. You could just math, you can formalize it. And he also influenced somebody named Thomas Malthus. And Thomas Malthus is the guy who we really want to look at today, who's going to be the next stepping stone, I guess. And he wrote his book, An Essay on the Principle of Population, in 1798. And he was also a professor of economics for the British East India Company as well. I think I have a picture of it too. Oh, yeah. Was it Space Bar? Yeah. Well, here's a picture of some of those guys I just mentioned. Thomas Malthus, that's the one on the bottom. I'll read.
Actually.
Yeah? Now, Malthus, here, this is a beginning excerpt of his essays on population, which are hugely influential even today. The power of population is so superior to the power of the earth to produce substance for men, that premature death must in some shape or other visit the human race. The vices of mankind are active and able ministers of depopulation. They are the precursors in the great army of destruction, and often finish the dreadful work themselves. But should they fail in this war of extermination, sickly seasons, epidemics, pestilence, and plague advance in traffic array and sweep off their thousands and tens of thousands. Should success be incomplete, gigantic inevitable famine stalks in the rear and with one mighty blow levels the population with the food of the world. Now, what's funny is about with Malthus over here is that he, by creating these elaborate calculations of mankind and how we multiply on the earth, he predicted that we would destroy ourselves or would overeat our earth by the end of the 19th century. That didn't come about, but you could see how he came upon that conclusion. Because he really saw humans as increasing exponentially, like 2, 4, 8, 16, 20, 32. And, you know, he looked at food populations, and food only reproduces arithmetically, like 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. You know, that's basic. You could look at that and see that, okay. And using that, and he developed a whole series of mathematics based on that, you could see where he came from. But this kind of takes out, it omits a certain idea. I mean, we're living testament to this. We didn't follow that equation, which by all empirical means seems completely plausible. I mean, you just look at it. That's how, you know, you might be able to identify how we grow, but we're here right now talking. So, I mean, what did he omit? Like, what is he not taking, or what isn't he able to look at when he was developing his theories? Well, he goes in later on. That's something to think about. I think JP will talk on that one a lot more. But only natural causes, like accidents, old age, war, pestilence, famine, and moral restraint and vice were the things that Malthus included in terms of what would check the population growth. And he included infanticide in that. You could rationalize some very scary things when you're going on this path of thought. He also favored moral constraint, like abstinence, getting married when you're you know, later in age, so he can't reproduce. But the thing is, these ideas that he considered solutions were really only things that he applied to the poor classes. So I mean, he saw that, you know, these people were poor. There's got to be a lesser quality. Like there's something in their genes that prevents them from being rich like me. I mean, me, Malthus. I mean, not me, Matthew. But there's something there that just prevents them. So, I mean, survival of the fittest. Like, this is something that they have to, you know, they're doing something. They're the cause of the problems. So he advocated and passed successfully a lot of the repeal of a lot of poor laws, social welfare laws, in order to counteract these problems. And you know, it completely degenerated the lifestyles of the poor in England. But luck, you know, it got his wish. I mean, the poverty went down. There was way to go. But this is Malthus, and he went on to argue another little excerpt here. This is another excerpt from his essays. This constantly subsisting cause of periodical misery has existed ever since we have had in any history of mankind. It existed present and will forever continue to exist, unless some decided changes take place in the physical constitution of our nature. So this is kind of an overbearing thing. Like, hey, we're pretty bad. People suck. We've always been this way because, you know, I'm assuming that. And it'll always be that way until we change the physical constitution of our nature, whatever he was getting at there. Which, so yeah, this is what he explained. And as an extra little bombshell, that went a little further, may or may not shock you people at this point, but in his autobiography, Charles Darwin, Charles Darwin admitted that he only got his theory from happening upon a certain work by Malthus. He wrote in October 1838 that is 15 months after I had begun my systematic inquiry, I happened to read for amusement Malthus on population, and being well prepared to appreciate the struggle for existence which everywhere goes on from long continued observation of the habits of animals and plants, it at once struck me that under these circumstances favorable variations would tend to be preserved and unfavorable ones to be destroyed. The result of this would be the formation of a new species. Here then I had at last got a theory by which to work. So, yeah.
Okay, so you took the theory as a basis.
As a starting point for a theory that, I mean, I don't know about you guys, this is sold pretty heavily to me throughout school. And this is, that's Julian Huxley. I just wanted to point out, too, that logic, if you continue along that train of thought, Charles Darwin basically proved that free market economics is human nature, too, if you really start peeking away at that. So, 100 years later, or a little less than that, after Darwin, maybe 40 years later, was this guy Julian Huxley who started really becoming very active in the world. And, no, it's actually Sir Julian Huxley. Yeah, I didn't emphasize that. Now he was an interesting fellow. He was the head of UNESCO in 1946, at which point he wrote up this document outlining. It was called UNESCO. It's Purpose and Philosophy, where he outlines the intention of UNESCO. And does anybody know what an UNESCO is, by chance? Yeah. What was that? Well,
UNESCO stands for United Nations Educational, Scientific, Socialist, Cultural
Organization. Yeah,
yes,
organization. Yeah, and Ilko is partially right. Like, they had a huge influence in shaping the education systems as well over the next coming years. But yeah, I mean, they were very. It's a very active board that's been doing a lot of things. But that was my main focus of why I brought it out, because. I mean, this is a really revealing document. I started picking away at this thing a few days ago and just started getting more and more shocked, which it was really tough to sort of stay on track in terms of what we're thinking about today. But
this is something, I if anybody wants a copy of this thing, I could send it to anybody online. It's pretty pretty enlightening. But it's UNESCO, the purpose and its philosophy.
Oh.
Yeah. So he basically, he was head of UNESCO at the same time, and this is where it starts getting a little bit more interesting. He was also head of the Eugenics Society. You had a big movement throughout the 30s in support of Hitler, Mussolini. Mussolini was in the Time magazine, Man of the Year, like three times. Hitler, too, 1932, mm-hmm. Or earlier, not 32. And it wasn't really anything to be completely ashamed of to be pro-eugenics back then. I mean, you had a bigger movement, and people were openly supporting things like fascism. But that sort of turned around when Hitler lost the war. And you know, you had a continuing of these philosophies, of this trend, but it had to change faces a little bit. This is before I get into that, actually. One thing I found in terms of linking Darwin, one of the in page 8 of Julian Huxley's work, he basically starts off that with this idea that we have to start off with a starting point of how human nature works in order to function as an organization. And then we can proceed. But we have to have a philosophy that will work out. And from there we can proceed. And he basically decides at that point, making it official, that natural selection... Well, does someone want to read this one, actually? Anyone else? Read the expert.
I can read.
Go for it.
It, natural selection, not only shows us man's place in nature and his relations to the rest of the phenomenal universe... not only gives us a description of the various types of evolution and the various types of trends and directions within them, but allows us to distinguish desirable and undesirable trends. It shows us the origin and biological roots of our human values. And finally, it shows us man as now the sole trustee of further evolutionary progress, and gives us important guidance as to further evolutionary progress. Thus, the general philosophy of UNESCO should be a scientific world humanism, global in extent and evolutionary in background.
Mm-hmm. So pretty much every school curriculum globally was basically influenced at this point by this Malthusian outlook. I mean, this is... the minds of generations to come. I mean, all of us were put in the hands of genocidal, elitists who are just on another world. So, yeah, I mean, back to what I was talking about with the eugenics, though. This is something else that he had to push as well at a later point in the document. you want to have another read for that one?
Even though it is quite true that any radical eugenic policy will be for many years politically and psychologically impossible, it will be important for UNESCO to see that the public mind is informed of the issues at stake so that much that is now unthinkable may at least become thinkable.
So, I mean, how would this be accomplished? What means would he go about developing this work into and manifest that into a society? And what you really have to look at is how human beings could be made to see themselves. I mean, back then, you know, you just had the defeat of Hitler. You had a cultural optimism. You had economic progress that was looking towards the future and developing. Like, FDR was really putting in policies at the time that had completely changed the culture as a whole, where people were building these massive infrastructure like New Deal. The Bretton Woods project was something that was a real possibility of development of all of Africa. I mean, creating the fixed exchange rate. Everyone in the world had changed and were really optimistic, and it wasn't a big thing. It wasn't really a real issue then to say that human nature is bad, because nobody believed that. You know, so how would that have to be changed? And it's funny, too, in another part of this document, he even compares
nationalism, how nationalism is something inherently destructive that causes wars, and he compares FDR's America with Nazi Germany's fascism, and saying that we have to transcend or bring people up to the ability to transcend these nationalistic ties and absorb or accept a world government. I mean, this is just empire repeating itself again. It sounds like a very comic book idea, but this is just, it's been there. This is the state of humanity. It's always been a battle between these ideas. So in terms of how he would bring people towards this, you have to look to 1961 for his next career choice. And while he was still head of the Eugenics Society, Julian Huxley co-founded a movement that would really spell the course of humanity in the next 40 years. And it was called the World Wildlife Fund. And what's interesting is when you look at the co-founders of this movement as well, because it wasn't just Julian Huxley alone. You had two other members too. One, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was a former Nazi SS officer, and the father of Prince Charles today, Prince Philip, the royal consort. Oh, wait.
Actually, I have some visual aids. Oh, there we go.
I mean, I know how I was saying before that supervillain or people who are evil don't tend to look like supervillains, but you know, I guess there's a bit of an exception for these folks. And I'm not too sure what they're looking at over there, but it's on top of Julian Huxley, he went on later on to found the International Union of the for the Conservation of Nature. Prince Bernhard too was also the founder of, if anyone's heard of this institution called the Bilderberger Group. It's been around since 1951.
Founder of the whole thing?
Yeah. It was founded after, it was a Bilderberger hotel where was the first meeting, but you've had globalist circles. Basically meet up, you know, people like you'll see them today, Henry Kissinger and David Rockefeller, and they'll meet periodically on an annual basis. Conrad Black hosted one in Canada in 2002. And it's becoming like, I mean, CNN's reporting it in the last couple of years. Like, this is something that 10 years ago people would say, like, Bilderberger, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. But, you know, it's come to a point now where it's a thing. This is a movement. Oh, and Prince Philip, too, I threw in a little... I don't know if you wanted to talk about this too, JP, or if I stole this from you, but there's an excerpt that I stumbled upon from this book that he wrote. Actually, this is from a newspaper interview with Deutsche Allgemeine Zeitung in 1987, where he said that if in the event that I am reincarnated, I would like to return as a deadly virus in order to contribute something to solve overpopulation.
And they don't like overpopulation.
They don't like people, no. They went on later on, this gets pretty elaborate, but I'm just going to go over the basic thrust over the next couple of years and then bring it back to JP. But they went on to found over the next, 9 years later, something called the 1001 Nature Trust. Well, Prince Bernhard and Philip did it, at least, which included pretty much... associates of the two and of these circles, of the Club of Isles, of raw materials cartels, bank insurances, central banks, fondies.
So why are you showing those guys?
I'm showing those guys just to give an example. Yeah, there's no... I didn't have to show all those names, really. But there, pretty much you had 1,000... a 1,001 people who were invited to take part and be part of this club, donate $10,000 a pop, especially by invitation only. You'll find, I mean, the real CEOs, the tops of all these cartels, and these guys formed a coffer of $10,001,000, and this went on to form and fund various movements from Earth First, Greenpeace in '69, various other outlets of the Sierra Club, and it went on to have a real octopus-like effect throughout the world. And it wasn't just money alone. Like, that won't do it. Wait. It offshot from the Sierra Club. David Ross Bauer. David Bauer was one of the first members. But it's just one of these offshoots that came off the Sierra Club after this quantity of money had started to become accumulated.
And
That was older. That went back to, like, 1940s, but it only became a sort of a actually, I think it was older than that, but it only became really, really active after the 60s.
You had this movement occur. I mean, the early 70s was probably the biggest moment of activity, where you really had a huge move to promote these ideas. Whereas, I mean, up till 1970,
here I'll just read through this little list I put together quickly. But there was the first chair of the World Wildlife Fund, Sir Peter Scott, who publishes a guide for the new masters of the earth, which it was a history textbook. Yeah, it was a history book for documenting the post-war environmental movement. So I just went into that. And in 1970, Maurice Strong, Canadian, creates Earth Day and to promote the World Wildlife Fund. Then he organized the first UN conference on the environment, which birthed the United Nations Environment Program. And then DDT was banned. I mean, you had this huge move where, I mean, you literally condemned tens and hundreds of millions of people to death by malaria in the third world by the banning of DDT as well. You had a whole move to limits of growth, which up until this moment, you still had, like, I've got an issue of Time National Geographic, where in it, it was talking about the climate change of the Earth. And every single scientist within this book is still talking about things like the cycles, the force of magnetism, radiation, Keplerian orbits. Like, these are things that, you know, they recognized that there were infinite variables, not infinite, but many, many millions of variables at play affecting this change that we're currently seeing. And you had this move to try and describe it by real science. And you had one little guy in the corner who was talking about how, who mentioned that man-made CO2 emissions were causing this. And you basically had him being, you know, he wasn't really getting any respect in this article. But it was kind of funny because you had this complete reversal back then, where now you have the opposite effect completely. But there was a real science. And the thing with that really inhibited the actual science of climate change was computer modeling. Limits to Growth was the big one that was propagated by the Club of Rome, whose founder, André Patelli, was also a member of the 1001 Trust Club. This was basically just finding a little computer whiz and a little crew, Jay Forrester was his name, to prepare computer models based on man's consumption of the quantity of foods and resources of the earth and how fast he's reproducing, and developing this all around this idea of carrying capacity. That was the big foundation for the work. And he ultimately concluded, and all the tests concluded, that humankind was causing not only the CO2 emissions were causing the destruction of, or the changing of the climate, but also that but it really started promoting overpopulation. And that's really it. Statistical analysis, it was 100% based on that. And this, it goes back, like, the idea of trying to use statistical analysis and computer modeling went back to, like, 1946 with Norbert Wiener. He was a scientist in Princeton who developed something called MANIAC. It was an abbreviation for something. It was called MANIAC. It was an abbreviation for something like mechanical, automated, blah, 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 blah. It was, ironically enough, had the right name. And that's when it started. But it really kicked off with the Limits to Growth book. And then you really started losing the science there, and it just got bigger and bigger with every year. You had the first UN conference on population in Romania. Kissinger, on December 10th, 1974, he wrote this incredible little work called the National Security Study Memorandum 200, Implications of Worldwide Population Growth for U.S. Security Overseas. For U.S. security overseas interests, where he literally points out 13 nations that would be targeted now for depopulation, because if they populate, their consumption of their own resources, they're all in Africa, would inhibit Western imperial desires for gain and for using that land. So you got to decrease the people there. And this is currently, I mean, this is what
we've got, but much worse in many scales, and but coming out of the Academy Awards with Al Gore pushing the same ideas again, and whether he knows it or not, I mean, is a byproduct of the fact that this intention is here, and it's how we choose to really allow ourselves to be guided by it or move above it, to actually look towards real science or the nature of this movement, or both. And it's with that bleak, I guess, finishing point that I'm going to leave it with JP, and we'll get back later on with certain elements of actual climate science and what we have to look at in order to really know what's happening. But I think that should give people a little bit to think about. And if you want to ask questions, we could have a little talk about this stuff later on. And JP?
Okay, maybe just put that down. Well, yeah, I got some, a few things here and there, but for now. So, okay, but I think from what Matt showed, I think people had a certain idea of, people heard about that. Maybe not from those people, but they heard about the same type of ideas being promoted here and there, right? Especially this question of what's called overpopulation. That man, just by doing stuff or by increasing its number, puts the world at risk. You know? And I think it's going to be very important to look at this question: what is man exactly? What are human beings? What is it that they do? But we're going to start by saying that in terms of get some thinking going. Because we know that there's a lot of people talking about this question of equilibrium, right? That, like for example, there was this article I read the other day by Hubert Reeves in the Journal de Montréal, where we talk about the fact that sharks have a role to play in the oceans because they eat certain type of fishes that if they don't eat them, well, they're going to spread and create other problems. So there's kind of an idea of an equilibrium. Okay, fine. But then what does man do in that equilibrium? Because it seems that man is screwing the whole thing. So, and from what I know, or from what I've... I would suspect that human beings come from the planet Earth. So we've been like, we're kind of a process of, you know, animalistic growth, you know. We just bomb here and say, let's destroy the whole thing, let's have a rave, and let's love the whole world. So if that's the case, then, you know, if Mother Nature created something which is destructive, which puts the whole Earth at risk, well, Mother Nature is not necessarily that wise. She made a blunder somewhere, if that's the case. Or maybe we fit in all this. So we're gonna look at that, and I just want to give two quotes of a bit like what we saw, but two people that are here right now. All right. First, people know about Hubert Reeves, Hubert Reeves. He's a big Canadian astrophysician. He's been one of the proponent of climate change, proponent of ecology a lot. And I'm going to show an interview he gave. It's in French, but I can translate the major parts of it. What he discussed about one of his books. That's 1986. Okay. And he's going to give his idea or his hypothesis about man. That's 1986. I had some discussion with people that there might be a certain change in the Hubert Reeves, you know, that things might be evolving, or I don't know. But for now, we'll see what this guy says. Because I've seen also these type of arguments in his books, his older books in the 80s. Oops. This is 1986. This is a man which is known as a reference, like worldwide, in terms of not just ecology per se, but also astrophysics. People can see. Someone can read that. Want to read? Yeah, this is Jacques Languiran, who is the interviewer. Funny man, if you see him. Funny laugh, but it's a funny interview. If you think about the consequences of what he's saying. Hey, how about you do Jacques Languiran and then do Barry?
Okay. Vous dites dans votre livre, l'humanité prépare frébilement son propre suicide.
Par l'armement nucléaire, d'une part, mais aussi par une sorte de destruction systématique de son habitat. C'est vraiment un aspect terriblement préoccupant.
Et vous vous posez aussi cette question fondamentale, à savoir si l'homonisation ne mènera pas naturellement à la catastrophe. Est-ce que, comme vous l'exprimez tellement bien dans votre ouvrage, la vie n'aura de sens que dans toute cette très lente évolution qui, après des milliards d'années, aboutit à une forme d'intelligence et une forme de vie plus complexe, mais qui ne saurait faire autre chose que de s'auto-détruire?
C'est le drame dans lequel nous sommes présentement d'entrevoir cette possibilité. Il a fallu 15 milliards d'années d'évolution pour préparer tout ce qu'on peut appeler l'infrastructure de la conscience, les atomes, les molécules, tout ce par quoi un cerveau fonctionne. 15 milliards d'années d'évolution des étoiles, des galaxies, des planètes, de tout l'univers. C'est ce qui est assez fabuleux dans cette nouvelle vision scientifique du monde. C'est tout l'univers c'est que tout l'univers est impliqué dans cette évolution. C'est ce qui fait de l'être humain l'enfant du cosmos et en même temps. Mais ce à quoi nous assistons depuis une cinquantaine d'années représente l'autre versant de la médaille, le côté gris, le côté ombre. En constatant ce que fait cette suprême merveille de l'univers, avec sa suprême et merveilleuse intelligence, il semble être en train de rendre cette planète inhabitable et de s'en extraire lui-même. Aux États-Unis, il y a quelques années, on vendait un jouet avec des manivelles, des roues, des ordinateurs, des programmes, etc. Lorsque vous le mettiez sur la table, le mécanisme s'enclenchait, le jouet se mettait en marche, des bras se mettaient à sortir et finissaient par se détruire complètement, jusqu'à n'être plus qu'un morceau de ferraille. L'être humain est-il une erreur de la nature? Je me pose la question, parce qu'on a tendance à penser que nous sommes vraiment les plus importants. Si on regarde l'évolution animale depuis 4 milliards d'années, on voit qu'ont existé plus de 10 millions de lignées animales, alors qu'il n'en existe encore aujourd'hui que 1 million. Seulement 9 millions ont été éliminés parce qu'ils n'étaient pas adaptés, ne sont pas arrivés à s'installer dans un régime d'échange ou d'équilibre dans lequel vous donnez et vous recevez. C'est ce qu'on appelle un écosystème. Et ceux qui n'arrivent pas à s'y intéresser sont éliminés.
Pensez-vous que nous ne serions pas adaptés?
Pour l'instant, nous sommes peut-être l'animal le moins adapté qui existe, précisément parce que nous sommes trop adaptés. Être adapté, cela veut dire vivre en harmonie avec le milieu. Est-ce que vous trouvez que les êtres humains vivent en harmonie avec la biosphère? Ils sont l'élément le plus destructeur qui soit en ce moment. L'activité principale des êtres humains sur la Terre se résume à la destruction des forêts et l'extinction accélérée de quantité d'espèces animales. Comme on a dit à un moment donné que l'océan est infesté de requins, on pourrait presque dire aujourd'hui que la planète est infestée d'êtres humains. le reste, so it goes in the same direction. So he's directly asking the question, well, is man a mistake? No. Which is a pretty it's a pretty important question. So, you know, if you want to, because if you want to help nature, you say, well, okay, let's get rid of the problem, which is you and me. That's one thing. And the other thing, which is from the David Suzuki Foundation. People know David Suzuki?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's my buddy. It's a very short thing. It goes along the same lines a little bit. But it's different. So this is not from Suzuki himself. It's from people working at the Suzuki Foundation about and they made a declaration of interdependence, that no man is dependent in the biosphere. And everything is interdependent, which was given in 2002. There was a summit in Rio. Sorry, 1992. Blah 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 blah. Yeah, I don't have the whole thing. But no, I just paraphrase it. If you go on his website, you'll see
Please bring me some water too.
It basically go by saying that man is one species out of 30 million. Okay. Like that's what we are. It's a bunch of species, and we're one of them. That man has right now reached a limit. That, you know, right now this is where the limit is. Now we have to kind of go back.
Limit of what?
Limit of growth, right? Because of the number, because of also the impact.
The limit of people on Earth.
Well, that's part of it. Because if man grows, use stuff. The more people, the more you use resources. That's kind of mathematical. But see this idea that man is one species among another. And this question of interdependence, because that's also a question. You know, when we talk about man being quote unquote superior, and does that mean that you have the right to, you know, make frogs smoke and bash caribous when you see them? See that there's a sick idea of superiority, like just like if someone's gonna tax, you know, take your lunch money at school, you can think he's superior. But that's not what we're talking about. We're trying to get to a sense of what man really is and how does that fit into all this. And there was one of the actions, especially of overpopulation, that I want to look into quickly. And what I'm going to do, because I'm going to get to my other point, is that I'm going to refute overpopulation and then I'm going to refute myself. Because I did that, I showed that at a class, you know, and then I just thought about what I'd said a few days after. I said, "Oh man, that wasn't." I hadn't made such a good point actually, so I'm gonna refute myself, which is a fun thing to do. Yeah, because a lot of people that were talking about overpopulation, especially in the poorer nations, right? If you just look at the stats, see that's what we're doing. We're using statistics. Of people per square kilometer in a nation. Like in Canada, you got 3. So we're yellow. The US a bit more, South America. And then you have these purple nations where it's a bit more packed. But already, right, with the stats, you can see, well, okay, Africa is not that many people. Not that many space being taken by men. Okay? But then when you look at India or China, then you see a lot more people. And if you look on the website of the UN, I've looked at the stats of 2005. For example, China, it has 157 people per square kilometer. And, you know, if a nation is overpopulated according to what we hear, that's China. India, it's double. It's 346. Right? It's pretty purple. But then if you look at Belgium, it's 360. So there's more people in Belgium per square kilometer than there is in India. And those nations right here, you're talking between from 9 to, well, let's say, 200. I think this is Nigeria. I think so. Not sure, but no. I think Nigeria is the most populated. And if you look at England, it's 120, right? And then you could argue with the statistics, say, well, that's almost like China. So who's really problematic? Is it really the poor? You know? But then if you refine your argument, you say, okay, well, we're going to look at cities now, right? Because, see, like here you got 3 person per square kilometer. But maybe someone can guess, but what if you look at Montreal, for example? How many people per square kilometer? Someone want to try to bet? 150. 150?
1,000.
Per kilometer?
Per square kilometer. And not 1,000? It's 5,500. Right? 5,500 people per square kilometer. 5,500. Right? So then what you thought about the former statistics, I just 157 about China, well, no. Then you know, there's a kind of a paradox there. Okay, so then let's look at an Indian city. Let's look at Calcutta. Then Calcutta has like 24,000, something. So, oh my God, it's 5 times more. So then okay, there might be a problem. But then again, if you look at Paris, it's the same number, approximately. Without tourists.
Yeah.
Add tourists.
It's
but
Calcutta
is like 24,000. So then you can say, well, you know, what's the real problem? You know, who is overpopulated, or what is it when we talk about overpopulation? Or why were people focusing on the poor nations? Why Africa, which seems fine, you know, people have these images of, you know, like dying Africans and they all crammed up together and say, well, there are too many. Well, so why in Belgium or in Japan? Now, in Japan, it's funny because you have one of the highest life expectancy in the world, you know, like 70-something years. So maybe they managed to solve a few problems. But the way I refuted myself, it's like, it's not like I don't have any friends, I just talk to myself, but if you look at a city like Montreal, let's take an example, so you have 5,500 people per square kilometer, but then you think, okay, well, what do these people do? Well, they eat, they have infrastructure, there's a bunch of things, and then you ask, well, where do these things come from? Like where does the food eaten by Montrealers, where does that come from? Does that come from Montreal? Well, partially, a little bit. But then you have places like in Montérégie, south of Montreal, which is a big breadbasket for Quebec, which is a lot bigger. Right. So then the land used by Montreal tends to grow. Right. Now you think, okay, well, how about those infrastructure? Where does the steel of Montreal come from? From Montreal? Well, no, it comes from up north, from mining, right? and so on and so forth. So you can imagine that now the man's activity is going to use a lot more land, right? So my argument with those statistics just does not really work. I didn't really make the point, right? But also it asks the question about, we're still on the point where we kind of have showed maybe a lack of rigor from the people talking about overpopulation. But then we're still able to ask ourselves, well, maybe that's the case, right? Because also it's
I didn't understand your point about how you refuted yourself.
Oh, well, like Montreal?
Yeah, so you're saying that we need the big places to like get the food and the...
Yeah, because people are saying, well, overpopulation, that you're going to basically lack land.
And you know? In Japan, where do they get their food and their steel? And
yeah, but it has the same question. That man's activity mm-hmm. is going to actually require, from what I'm saying, it's going to require more land, so you're taking a lot more space. So in a sense, your land, it's not that you have necessarily more people per land, but you're using a lot of it.
It's like the statistic is not very helpful. It doesn't tell
well,
you...
We're
Well,
it's not sufficient.
Yes,
you give a sense, like with, yeah.
The question is resources more than land per se.
Well, by getting your resources, you're going to need land. So if you have a mine, if you have a dam.
Well, it's like always there is a kind of pyramid where the poor countries give whether they like it or not. All these,
yeah, like it or not.
All these resources, all these
yeah.
steel,
okay.
The all the minerals, everything come from Africa, South America, a little bit of
yeah.
from Asia.
Yeah, but you see, even if, for example, we didn't have all those bad guys that Matt talked about, because maybe they identified something that was true. No, but we see the intention of, you know, population reduction, and then it kind of intersect the, or counter this question that you know, man is kind of important, that we don't, as you were saying in the beginning, you know, if you have a chance to help a child, you help him out. If you have a chance to help a village, you tend to say, I'm going to help them out. Not by reducing their, you know, preventing them from breathing my air, so I have more air for me, but or more air for others, but by helping them as human beings. Yeah.
So basically, is it you're trying to say that we're taking that exact same map and those same statistics and just you can show us whatever information you want. You can go from one side or the other and taking
well,
any statistics, you can play them whichever way you want. Like
there's probably parts of it. What I did, I try to follow a certain
yeah,
rigor.
Yeah.
Yeah. But just the statistics themselves, I got to a point where by using physics,
right.
I said, okay, well, it's fine, Montreal, all these people, blah, blah, but they're going to actually require a lot more land. So then the discussion kind of changes. It's not just about how many people you have in a square kilometer, but it's what is it you do with the land. So you could say that actually overpopulation.
Sorry. Sorry.
I was talking to you. So then you can say that overpopulation, I mean, maybe it was like, you know, like 100 years ago, just with 3 billion people, then we're like, as David Suzuki was, or not Suzuki, but his foundation, we're saying, we were over the top already. But also, we should ask ourselves a question about the method that we're employing. Right? I know if a lot of people here already made astronomical observations.
A what?
Astronomical observation, like observing the sky at night or during the day. Clouds. Has anyone done astronomical observations recently, the last 37 years. Yeah, because we did, actually we did the other day, but for me it was the second time in 3 years, so it's not like I'm out there all the time. But, because we're studying a guy named Kepler, Johann Kepler, who demonstrated the orbits to be elliptical, not circular. And you got into a bit the same type of problem, where people before him tried to explain how the solar system was functioning, but they got different system. They got to different conclusions. One got the Earth in the middle of the solar system, and it was some were pretty cookie for us right now, because now people have a sense that the center is the Earth. Well,
the sun.
The sun, yes. The sun is in the middle of our solar system. Yeah. But some others were using got to a mechanism where the Earth was in the middle, for example. The sun were rotating around the Earth, and everything else was rotating around the sun, right? So you can imagine all, it's your solar system going around the Earth. And all these different systems would explain what was being seen, the data that people had. That day, Mars is that position, because people were looking at Mars, the planet Mars, and there's also, if you look in the sky for a very long time, not for a few hours like we did, for many months, you're gonna see there are certain planets whose actions are retrograde, meaning that they pass in the sky and through days they seem to go back and then to go again. You have Mars, Saturn, and Jupiter. They all do this at different intervals. And we got lucky because we had a planisphere, like a solar chart, a little map to see where are the stars, and we had this cool thing where you can just, you know the date, you know the time, right? You move it, and you have your sky. And we had the map, so it's a lot easier. But the funny thing is that we stayed out for an hour, almost two, and we decided, okay, we're going to spot a star, and we're going to see how it's going to move. We stayed like for ages, and it barely moved, a little bit. Because my point is that to get a sense of how those things are working, there's a lot of work to put in. It was kind of cold that night, and now it's getting better. Maybe global warming will help promote astronomy, I don't know. Get people out more for a longer time, but if you stay out for a few hours, then you're able to start looking at how things are functioning. And also, if you want to see those retrograde actions, you're talking about weeks of observations. It's very rigorous, and you gotta think that through. And a question that Kepler asked, which is the same question that we're asking right now, about different types of systems, trying to explain whether it's astronomy or human behavior, you gotta look at the physics.
Because it's true that I'm going to show them there.
Pizza Tower. So this is human population through quite some time. That's the year zero. Jesus Christ. That's before. So you see, for example, here it's going down. That's at the time of the plague in Europe. But then from that point, since the Italian Renaissance, population of Europe has been going up increasingly. But not just that, though. Then you get also the population density. People per square kilometer, and also life expectancy.
We can't really see it because it's too small.
Well, the numbers aren't that important, but you see there's a growth, like life expectancy around 70 years, population around 120, density, few. I know goes up to just 1975, so probably higher now. So there are things that mankind did that allowed it to grow. And to grow, well, almost exponentially. But then you have people like Suzuki, who said, according to our sources, people that we met recently and who had met him, who had heard what his presentation, that he said, and he said that before as well, in 1990-something, I said it in the magazine, but he said that the only thing that grows geometrically, like that, or exponentially, I'm sorry, exponentially, is cancer. So whether Mother Earth is suicidal, she listened to Kurt Cobain too many times, I don't know. or there's something we just didn't get, or there's some other people that are trying to get us to believe into something, so we gotta keep that rigorous. Because that's what we have to think about, the type of policies you're gonna promote, or the type of vision that you have about men. If you get to the conclusion that man is a cancer, it questions many things, right? Well, then what about education? What about health care? What do we do with those people? You know, and the famous, you know, there's a big problem you get in society, not just in ecology per se, but there's this big what if. What if this? What if that? Like Bush or Cheney, they try to promote a war, try to justify a war. At a certain point, their arguments are just shitty. And then they say, well, what if? What if while we're talking, you and me, these guys are building bombs? We just don't know about it. You want to take a chance? Uh-huh. And they say, okay, let's go bomb. Because there's this big what if. You know? And you get the same thing in ecology. Well, let's say, for example, about nuclear energy, which is a very powerful energy, and say, well, what if? You know, what if you build nuclear weapons and nuclear
plants,
and they explode or something happens? You know? So then you get the same thing also around, you could say you get the same thing with education. But what if this kid turns bad? These guys are from the ghetto. You want to give them an education. You might do something evil with that. What if? You know? Then you can see that we kind of get to... We can even go towards, well, depopulation. Why should we keep these people alive? They're problematic. Well, they might become problematic, so therefore, let's put them... Let's whether isolate them. No, let's keep them aside. Let's get rid of them. So we got to start developing a certain question of honesty in terms of science. We've got to look at causes and got to look at the physics of all this. You know, like this question there: how is it that we came about to have this population? Like, would we just do that like that? No. If so, well, why is there a curve right there? Is it just like magical, or is there a phenomenon that creates that? And if there's a phenomenon that creates that, well, is this phenomenon a good thing or a bad thing? Because you could say that just too many people, you know. And by keeping in mind what we said at the beginning with those people, maybe you can open for Matt to look into a bit this question of climate change per se, like the modelings. And so we should go also into the physics of these different hypotheses in astronomy.
Sure.
Because, yeah, just one last thing in terms of making the point. It's a little joke. Really bad joke, I won't explain it. This is the first page of the book of Euclid. People heard about Euclid?
Wait,
is a people are. It's been mentioned, Belarus, a lot as a, I don't know if you use the term scientific fascist, but he talks a lot, he associates Euclid with the description of sophistry. That has to do a lot with what we're getting today in terms of this whole propaganda around climate change. Because there's one thing that Gore and other people do as well. Like, people heard about this report from the World Bank, Nicholas Stern, huge thick-ass report about the economic consequences of climate change. It's very catastrophic, you know, 20 feet of water, all, you know, like thousands of billions of dollars in the garbage. But these people, they don't say, they say, okay, there is a man-induced climate change. And we're trying to show that there might be climate change, but it has necessarily nothing to do with man-induced or by man's activity. Because what you get a lot in the street when you say, well, when you bring certain axioms about the fact that it might not be man, it might just be nature itself, or it might just be a regular phenomenon, people will say, well, what about Al Gore's argument, or what about the UN's argument about this or that? Now, they say that it is warming up. You're contradicting the UN, contradicting these guys. When you ask, okay, well, how do they get to that conclusion? You don't want to just take the authority. But then what the people do sometimes, they ask you, say, prove to me that the UN is wrong. Or prove to me that, that, you know, that the water won't go up, you know, 20 feet in the future. Well, then the real question the real answer to that is to say, well, can you yourself prove that? No? Can you prove what are really the causes behind all this? Because you're being shown the conclusion, a bit like Euclid, who's trying to define what we know in terms of geometry. And the famous one is always the number one, which says a point. So what is a point? Well, a point is that which has no parts. Agree with that? Do any problems with that? How do you usually call something that has no parts?
Nothing.
I don't know.
Pointless.
It's pointless. But then if you keep going, okay, there's a line. A line is a breadthless length. And three, the extremities of a line are points that has no parts. Right? A straight line is a line which lies evenly with the points on itself. Then he goes into the surface, goes into the things. And he goes for, there's a bunch of pages. So you have someone who will describe things. And the point is a funny thing, because when you think about a point, you say, how can I describe a point? Because if you make a point with your pencil, there's always a moment where you can say, well, is it a point or a small circle? Or just like a stain? Or so, okay, well, I'll make it smaller. Well, but yeah, but still it's a little circle. Or it's a irregular shape or whatever. But then how, okay, well, then the point is so small it has no parts. Right? It's the tiniest thing you can ever conceive of. It has no parts. Okay, well. And LaRouche, in his latest paper, talked a lot about a guy named Nicholas of Cusa, who was one of the founder of modern science and who is looking at the causes. Like what, for example, would create a point? Not just describing things. Like, we meet a lot of people that got the description of Kepler's laws in astronomy. But do they know how to get there? Right? People heard about climate change and all these things, but do they know how these conclusions came about? Right? And do they know what are these people's mindsets, you know, that got them to generate? What was their intention? Where are they going? like, you know, Tony Blair is one of the main promoters of climate change, but also one of those idiots that would be one of the very few to support George Bush in terms of a war with, you know, the whole world. Yeah. And Kuza, I don't know if I have it here. And just to give you an example, but if you do some more work later, I have my...
What do you want again?
What do I want?
This?
No, no.
It has something to do with the topic of it.
Oh, yeah, because it has, it, does it have the article? Yeah.
The paper?
Mm-hmm.
Just, yeah.
Okay, no.
I'm...
Well, maybe there's something I need in there. But Kepler, Kuza talks a lot about this question of circular rotation. Because when you do astronomy, if you're patient enough, if you have a good coat, you'll see that things are actually rotating. That what you see is, you know, when you have all the stars moving, actually moving. If you're in Montreal, you see that they're moving. Like the North Pole is kind of in that direction. If you stand where we were, of course. And there's a rotation of all the stars, right, in that direction, like that. And then you try, of course, you try to measure, you try to pinpoint those things. And Kuza shows that actually by using the circle, we're using the circular action. Right? I just need the white sheet. There you go. Yeah, like by applying circular rotation. Right? You have a sheet. So the circular rotation would be, if you imagine the sheet, it does this angle. Right? That's fine. And then by putting the action of folding like that, then while you sheet, there's something different, which is that little thing here. And then by folding again, right? Well, then you get, right, you get two of those lines, which by intersecting creates a point, which, you know, you can spend many hours trying to measure your point, see if it really has no parts. But now we're looking at the cause, we're looking at the physical action that creates those things. You just want to look at the physical actions that will create whether this population growth or that will also that will create environmental problems. Because there are environmental problems. Probably more right now because of the whole economy collapsing and having a bunch of people thinking like beasts as well. So yeah, so keeping that in mind, let's look at the climate change per se.
Well, there's this saying by Confucius that I read up on. Popped in my mind when I was listening to JP. That goes, "The greatest sin one can commit is if he realizes that the axioms that he lives by are wrong, and yet still chooses to live by those axioms." It's paraphrasing. It's not exactly Confucius, but it's what I can remember. And I think ultimately that's really the key in getting at what it is that we're facing with this drive of people to say that man is causing, or CO2 is the cause, this is the cause, and not be able to really scientifically back up why they are saying what they say. I mean, there's a huge consensus. I mean, everybody agrees, you know, but really, why? And we just conducted an intervention with Al Gore at the Palais du Congrès last week, where he was speaking amongst for the whole, well, there was him in a whole bunch of panels throughout the whole day speaking to business leaders and pretty much the highest class of Quebec for a day. And one of our members, Megan, was able to get in and listen to what he had to say. And she brought back something kind of funny and scary at the same time in terms of his introduction. When he came out, the first thing that he did in setting the pace for his presentation was he described Venus. And he described the temperature of Venus. It's 450 degrees Fahrenheit, pretty hot. He described the Celsius, thank you. Yeah. He described the acid that rains out of the skies. And the first thing he mentioned was that it obviously has nothing to do with proximity to the sun. It's the CO2 levels that are in it. And he just really pulled upon that. So, okay, all right, this big giant ball of heat and radiation in the middle of our solar system has nothing to do with the fact that Venus is hot. It's CO2. So, I mean, that's some scary. That's pretty scary stuff if you're not equipped to question things that are told to you by somebody who just is, you know, might be winning a Nobel Prize or an Academy Award. So, I mean, in terms of going at the CO2 thing, I was just figured I'd look at that a little bit and see what some other studies had to say about just that alone. And there is no doubt that, you know, you look at all the studies, there is definitely a correlation between CO2 and temperature rising. You could look at the records back for hundreds of millions of years, and you'll always find them moving in sync, hand in hand. But is the cause of the climate change? Well, that's a question worth asking and looking through. Because it's really, that's where you start finding holes in the accepted story, so to speak. Like, there's a Canadian geochemist, he's just spoken with some of our interviewers with the EIR, our magazine that we put out, who has spoken about how the actual data that you receive from the ice cores lags from 100 to 1,000 years. The CO2 will lag the temperature rising. So, you know, while you look at these temperatures moving, or these stats moving in conjunction with each other, we tend to overlook the fact that, yeah, the CO2 actually tends to trail the temperature, which is sort of relevant. And you can look at other things, too. Like, we've had a little ice age, which Gore will mention. He'll talk about it a little bit. But, you know, about 200 years, around the time of the American Revolution, a little while afterwards, you had no summers. It was perpetually
cold. Did you say the CO2 was trailing?
Trailing by 100 to 1,000 years. Yeah.
So they say it's
was
like
before.
Warm.
The CO2 was before the warmth?
No, the CO2 came after the warmth. The warmth came first. So the CO2 is actually a byproduct of the warmth. Okay. So it's something that couldn't, if it comes afterwards, you couldn't have it causing it, really.
Yep. I'm just wondering, if it comes after, like, when there be less, seeing as the sun makes more green vegetation, which absorbs CO2, so when you have more warmth, you should be having more green vegetation, meaning you should have less CO2?
If it's just the sun?
Yeah.
If
it's just the sun, I mean, why would you have more CO2 after? Shouldn't there be more green vegetation to allow it to, like, be recuperated and, like...
Well, I think I get... Well, there's, like, plants... there's this huge process of... like, CO2, first of all, in terms of what man's producing, I don't know if I got the question exactly, but is, like, most of the actual man-made emissions, the CO2 takes up a very small percentage of the gases in our atmosphere. It's mostly water vapor, by and large. Comes down to maybe 4% of it is actually CO2s, and of that, like, the... What's attributed to man is even smaller.
Effect.
Yeah, the greenhouse effect. Yeah. Yeah, and plants do tend to thrive in CO2, but we overlook the fact that what man causes might not actually be causing the temperature rising, and that like you've had what I was just going to talk about was just the little ice age that occurred around the time of the revolution, where you had one of the biggest volcanic explosions of our time in the Caribbean. Which projected massive amounts of CO2 into the atmosphere on Earth, and really caused we don't know exactly the true causes of these temperature fluxes yet, because our science has sort of been cut off on it. But that occurred at the same time, and people would describe in writing how you'd have the moon, which was blood red almost on a regular basis, indicating that's one of the indicators of how much volcanic emissions and ashes are in the atmosphere. When you see the temperature or the moon taking on these characteristics, but then also, I mean, you could look towards other details too, like how 450 million years ago, you know, there was about 10 times more CO2 in our atmosphere than there is today. But, I mean, interestingly enough, can you guess what type of environment was going on in 450 million years ago? It's pretty interesting.
Ice age?
Yeah, good guess. Yeah, it was an ice age. And so, you know, you have, you know, if you look at details like that and then continue to push on these policies that are being driven by studies that don't acknowledge elements of this, or even like the hockey stick, there's a certain hockey stick graph which has become pretty prolific in pretty much all around the scientific communities these days, indicating how the progression of the heat over the last 1,000 years. And you'll see it, and this is the first thing that Al Gore popped out, or one of the things that Al Gore popped out in his movies to make his point. But you'll have this progression of heat moving at a very slow pace, whereas around the time of the Industrial Revolution, it just skyrockets, and especially since 1940, it goes into the stratosphere. And it's called the hockey stick graph because it just takes on the characteristics of a hockey stick. But
it's a stability, and then there's a short rise.
Yeah.
Here, it's actually... Yeah, this is the official
IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is one of the primary bodies that conducts a lot of the research on these things, and this is the official hockey stick graph now, and that line right there is current modern times, and the projected what-ifs are on the far right-hand side there. Now, you have a certain omission of fact, even, which has just which has just arisen too, by this. It first of all came around. It was called the MBH 900 report or 98 report because it was put out in 98, and it was used to fuel massive amounts of legislation and environmentalist bills that have passed since then, prohibiting industrialization, prohibiting a lot of man's ability to basically grow. But there was this doctor, Ernst George Beck from Germany, who found, he went through about 178 of the studies that were used and found that there were about 90,000 pieces of evidence of carbon emissions that were emitted from the statistics that were used to get this result. And he found that, I mean, for the last, even this century, goes back to, in 1940, you had 390, today's carbon dioxide emissions are measured at about 375 parts per million on average. But what this reveals is that it actually went as high as 390 to 454 around the 40s, and then there were other measurements taken in 1885 that go up to before this graph to 375 parts per million, 1866 in different parts of Europe 390 parts per million, and then 1857 farther back still 416 parts per million. So you've got this. These things that don't seem to add up, and a lot of these stats were taken by Nobel scientists as well, which, once again, were just completely omitted. So, you know, at what point do we say, like, well, why would you do that, or how is this modeling working? And that's what we're really trying to get at here. And also, like, on top of the little ice age, because there was actually a period. Around the 1100s to 1200s, where you had a period of massive warming, which is also not really, which is omitted also from this graph.
But, Greenland and northern England were known for having vineyards. I mean, the Vikings were planting on what is currently tundra. You can't plant or grow vineyards in Greenland today, but there's a point in there that's not on that graph that you showed that you could. I mean, it's on the graph in that time, or that National Geographic I was talking about from 1976. They got it there. But, I mean, for some reason, we're not using that data. So... What we have to look at, and what scientists knew, is that up until computer modeling took over, was really that, what we have are cycles, smaller cycles containing bigger cycles containing even larger cycles. But there's a process of dynamic warming and cooling that's occurring here. But you can't just measure CO2 and measure heat, or even methane, which is like smaller than takes up maybe like. Of all the man-made emissions, methane is like maybe 7 to 11%, CO2 is like 70%, and it's just, these are what people are blaming it on. It's like, I had somebody stop me in the street and say that, oh no, it's not about CO2, it's about methane. Well, it's even less. Like, what are you really looking at? Well, so, it's at this point that, I think it's useful to think big, and think, by big, I mean astronomical. And we have to look at Earth's history and as being not just contained within our lifetimes. Like, we can't just measure what came before us, what's going on around us now, and just project what trends we see into the future, but really be able to conceptualize what point in time we're existing in and what came before us. And if you look back to 1,800 years or 18,000 years ago, I mean, just imagine Canada right now underneath 1 to 2 miles of ice. All the way down to half of Canada had, like a mile of ice over it. That was an ice age. I mean, we don't have any sign of that today, but just conceptualize that. But then also too, we are currently in a little warm temperate period. This is called the Holocene, but we, over the last million years, and have had 8 successive periods of massive ice ages that go on for about 100,000 years a pop. In between, you have these little periods of Holocene, the Holocene, or little temperate periods like that go about 20,000 years a pop, which involve a warming. But, I mean, you could go even further. You know, like, there's smaller cycles contained within these. These are themselves, you could, if you look even further, you could look back 250 million years ago and realize that there was a period of warming along the planet Earth, which was like 12 degrees hotter than it is today. And that went on up until about 50 million years BC. But this is like a massive chunk of heat. And it's something that we have to start seeing ourselves as. Because, I mean, if you look at human history, all humans have existed on this planet for what? Like maybe 2 million years. And, I mean, of that time, written record goes back, what, maybe like 5,000 years? Thereabouts. If you take, I mean, just thinking about a massive volume of encyclopedias, human history takes up maybe like a few sentences, and that's 2 million years. Of that, maybe, of what we know, maybe half a comma. It's pretty, like, kind of makes you think, like, what do we have to look at to really understand our place in the universe? So this was the type of thing scientists were looking at, and we have to really move, because there's still scientists, many that are continuing to push this need to look back towards astrophysics and the movement of the planet and Keplerian orbits as being something to consider in looking at why we're currently experiencing this change in climate. I mean, up until the 70s, you had, or 1920, a good guy to look at really was. There was a scientist, a Russian geochemist named Milutin Milankovitch. And I don't suppose anybody's heard of him, have they? What? Yeah? Nice. Milutin Milankovitch? Huh? He was pretty renowned, especially in the 20s. He developed this work, it's called the... Huh? Yugoslav? Oh, maybe. I think he was Russian, though. Huh. Okay. No? Sergei?
From Serbia.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, damn. Sorry, Nora.
You just hurt my feelings.
Okay. Well, okay, aside from his where he came from, he was a pretty smart he's a pretty smart guy, and he had a certain sense of rigor, and he developed this work called The Mathematical Theory of Heat Phenomenon Produced by Solar Radiation, which outlined these three primary factors governing climate change, which use Keplerian orbits. Primarily, he broke them down into three things: the precession of the equinoxes, the axis tilt, and the eccentricity. Now, I'm not a complete expert on climate change myself, but I mean, there are a few little concepts here that I think are a good starting point to maybe work on and get a sense of in terms of what we do need to look at. Now, this guy, just to show or maybe demonstrate a little bit of what this guy did. Now, the three primary factors that underlie all the cycles run by measurements of 20,000, 40,000, and 100,000 year cycles that interconnect with each other. Now, the 20,000-year cycle is called the precession of the equinoxes. Well, does anybody have any idea what that means?
Huh? Yeah. The age of Aquarium.
It's what we're... is the dawning, yeah? But what?
That's actually related to that.
Yeah.
Direction of the Earth's axis points around which it spins.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't just stay in one direction, but that cycle rolls around in a circle.
Yes, okay, so the Earth's axis rotates in a little circle around
that'll trace a circle in the sky.
Yeah, throughout the entire zodiac. The stars of the zodiac. Yeah. Okay. So you got that cycle. That's 20. Well, you've got the Earth's axis, which points to a certain spot in the zodiac, and that spot doesn't always just move and point to that same. That axis doesn't always point to that same spot, but it has various actions associated with it. And over 26,000 years, that axis will proceed through all of the 12 zodiac signs. Each one's like 30 degrees, right? So it'll take about 26,000 years for it to go through, 25,000 some years for it to make its precession all the way through them. So that's a factor in regards to climate change, according to Milankovitch. And that occurs every, that's one. Then you also have something called the Earth's eccentricity, the Earth's eccentricity is what Kepler defined as being the path of. Well, he discovered that finally orbits weren't round; they were actually elliptical. And what you have is center of gravity being the sun, being not in the middle but towards one extreme or the other. This one actually could be a little closer. Now, this always changes. The Earth is never the Earth's orbit is never the same. It's always in a process of change. You can know the characteristics of it. You can understand it, but it's always going to be changing. And at certain points, the sun will be closer or further away from the Earth. And that eccentricity, that effect, is what causes 100,000 year cycles in the Earth's climate. And then also you have the Earth's axis tilt, which goes because the Earth's axis, while not only is it always rotating, it's always changing, but there's the actual tilt itself. It will tilt to be more oblique or less oblique from the sun on a 40,000 year basis as well. So this goes from like 25 degrees to 22 degrees, to 22.5 degrees on another rotational basis. Today we're like at 23.5 degrees or something. But this is something that also is occurring. So the Earth's axis goes from
back and forth, you know, so you'll have the Earth not only spinning around as the precession of the equinox occurs, but you'll also have this Earth axis tilting a little bit too. And that's really what causes what Milankovitch discovered as deciding how much insulation radiation is entering the Earth's atmosphere.
You mean the whole orbit is tilting?
Not the whole orbit. Well, no. You have the... this is called the plane of the ecliptic. There's a certain thing that we measure all movements and positions of the Earth too, like the axis. And this plane of the ecliptic is what you'll find residing, like the Sun and the Earth will be found on that plane. And then you'll have other planets like Mars that'll be slightly on a different... Their planes, like the Earth's orbit, will be on a slightly tilted or oblique angle to that plane. But if you measure it according to that plane, you'll always find that 22 to 20, 25 degree change always occurring. Yeah.
Because if you have a circular orbit, the tilt was 90 degrees,
yeah,
you will not have seasons. Because the radiation will be always the same.
Yeah.
You're in the same distance from the sun, you have the same amount of radiation in the north.
Yeah, right. And that's it. And the thing that causes the, like a lot of the ice ages, that decides whether or not we're going to have an ice age. Because, I mean, there's occasionally there's times where Earth is literally a ball of ice or a ball of snow. But then there's sometimes that it has hardly any snow throughout these massive periods like of millennia. And really what decides these ice ages is really what he identifies as insulation, the quantity of radiation not leaving the Earth's atmosphere. But being decided, like if we have over a particularly colder summer, if we don't have enough heat or radiation to melt the ice caps, which are coming down into Canada, into the U.S., if you don't have enough to melt that back, you basically trigger an ice age. Because right now, what we've had every year has been enough warming that has just allowed these ice caps to melt all of what they've developed, like all of the ice that's accumulated. There's been enough heat and insulation that's caused by the tilt of the Earth and the quantity of radiation hitting us that's allowed it to melt. But if you don't have that, when that quantity is not adequate, you have a critical mass which kind of occurs, and the quantity of ice will grow, and you'll have what we had 18,000 years ago again, which is a culmination of
it's a feedback too, because the ice is more reflective.
Yeah. Yeah, so it grows exponentially, I guess. Yeah, that's. But these are the basis. Like, we still don't understand really everything about what we're feeling today. I mean, this is the type of direction that modern science has to move towards again. And you had this, like, this became Milankovitch became very very commonly accepted by the 70s. But this has just completely been erased from all of our textbooks and all of our. Largely, just like Bertrand Russell's quotes, or Malthus, I mean, these things aren't looked at. So, you know, think about solar wind, Earth's electromagnetism, the tectonic plates. I mean, the Earths are, the positions of the continental drift are always shifting, too. Like, these are all elements that play into each other and with each other. And what we've had most recently, and Lyndon LaRouche is really enthusiastic about this, because you've had the Danish National Space Center, which has just released some studies on cosmic rays and how they change the climate. And you've got a collaboration between the University of Ottawa and the Hebrew University in Jerusalem with Nir Shaviv and Jan Vezier, who have identified how you have also a 500 million year change in hot houses and cold houses according to the in hot and cold cycles. According to Earth's and the Sun's, our entire solar system, our whole solar system?
The Sun's rotation around the galactic center.
Yeah, exactly, the galactic center itself, because we are also moving as well as we're moving within a galaxy. Yeah, we're moving in a galaxy. So we're moving at a massive speed around the galactic center. And this is identifying a new factor that we have to take into account.
regarding what's occurring. And this, why Linus is really excited about this, is that not only does this force us to leave our own little bubble of, you know, our life, what we see is occurring on our planet right now, by us in this case, but it not only forces us to leave this to go into the solar system, but then go into the universe like mankind has never really done in terms of thinking of that effect or to those extent. And that's a pretty potent way of really getting us out of this trap of empiricism and of just sense perception. So, because there's certain things that our minds will only be able to tell, or our feelings, our senses, sight, sound, will only be able to tell us so much. There's infinite more that the human mind is only capable of doing, because it uses what it sees and feels in combination with its reason, with our reason, and make these discoveries, like Kepler discovered gravity, by not, you know, using just his observations like everyone else was doing, but actually going beyond that. Or how will we discover the nature of real climate change or the motions of our solar system? Well, we can't rely on what we see. And so with that, I guess I'll just shove off there and leave it to JP. Finish up.
Has anyone seen the Gore movie? Al Gore's Duck Nukem?
Yeah, that's quite impressive. The first time you see it, it's kind of...
It's made to impress. Mm-hmm. You don't get an award because you're not impressive. That's what you said? Is that what you said? You said this? I should speak up? Because there's one thing which is being done in that movie or documentary, which there's a point I wanted to make to get a sense of this question of politics and what he ended up with sense perception. But there's a part where Al Gore will show the curve of the ice ages, which is like a 1 foot tall curve, blue curve, which shows a difference of 10 degrees. You know, if it's warm, it's kind of fine. If it's low, it's like you have between 1 and 2 miles of snow on your head. And then, so it, you know, it's something which is measured with degrees Celsius. And then when he shows it, he shows another curve, which is a CO2 curve, which is a different measurement, which is about 20 feet high in the way he shows it. And then he gets into his platform with and then, you know, this is in, I forget if it's 50 or 100 years, but those are like 50 or 100 years. So in case you have two things that measure something which is awfully different, you have this big red curve and this tiny blue curve. And he says, well, if this little blue curve is a mile of snow on your head, you know, in the cold, imagine that curve, which is in the warmth, will be a consequence of that. So you look at that and say, oh my God, it's like, you know, 1,000 degrees or something. It's gonna burn, you know. And then the forecast of the UN, you know, the IPCC, it's like you're talking about 1 or 3 degree increase in 50 or 100 years. Which is like if you take your blue curve, it's like a little tiny thing on it. So then you ask yourself, well, what the hell is he trying to do? What's that thing you just did right there? And that brings us back to Plato, a good buddy Plato. And there's a dialogue which is called Gorgias, where you see Socrates and who's asking Gorgias about, because Gorgias is a big guy, renowned, you know, through Greece, because he speaks about everything. He's got it. And Socrates just asked him, he said, well, what is it you do? What's your art? What is it you do? And Gorgias, first Gorgias doesn't answer, then it's his ass licker Polis. Goes, Gorgias does the most beautiful art. Sorry, he says, well, okay, but what is that? Can you elaborate? And if you read, you should read that. It's I keep saying it's the only only dialogue where Socrates will curse. Okay. So it tells you a bit the what's going on in there. It's a big fight. Especially Polus, he gets he gets blasted by Socrates. So then Gorgias jumps back and he says, well, no, my art is the art of speech, of speaking, of discourses. Then Socrates says, well, what is it? Do you talk about medicine? Because you're not a doctor. He says, no, I don't talk about medicine. Do you talk about music? Because you're not a musician. Wouldn't you rather ask a musician to talk about music? Why you? Then he goes, well, I guess the musician would be better. Yes. Then he goes into saying, well, I talk about the just and the unjust. Or the art of politics. Then then they keep discussing a little bit. And then Gorgias goes into a more elaborated definition of what he does. And he says, and he's using an example. He says, well, look, I remember I went to see my friend who's a doctor, and he had this patient that didn't want to take the medicine. So I went there and I convinced the patient to take the medicine. So I persuaded the patient better than even the doctor could do with all his knowledge. Isn't that beautiful? Like, I have no idea of this medicine, or just a little bit,